This is The Takeaway for Thursday, October 10th. I'm Tanzina Vega. After the U.S. withdraws troops, Turkish forces invade Syria, leaving an American ally unprotected.
This is a very uneven match. Turkey is the ninth most powerful military in the world. The Kurds have vintage equipment, no air force.
All the background on how our Kurdish allies helped the U.S. defeat ISIS before this reversal of policy and the risks to civilians on the ground. Also on the show, Senator Warren spoke out recently about pregnancy discrimination, and we're talking to you about it.
I actually had a supervisor tell me just after my wedding, you'd better not plan on getting pregnant or we'll lose you in a layoff.
Plus, parts of California are in the dark, so we'll shine a light on what choices PG&E faces as they try to power the state. That plus racist traditions in sports like the tomahawk chop and why they're still a thing. But first, the Turkish invasion of Syria. For years now, the United States government has armed and supported a Kurdish militia known as the Syrian Democratic Forces, or the SDF, and they were instrumental in the fight against ISIS in the area along the Turkish border. But on Sunday, in a move criticized by experts and policymakers across the political and ideological spectrum, President Trump abruptly decided to withdraw all U.S. forces from the Syria-Turkey border. On Monday, 50 American special forces were removed from a section of the Turkish border, leaving a security vacuum in the area and opening the door to a bloody explosion of a decades-long conflict. After a phone call on Sunday with Turkish President Erdogan, President Trump released a statement announcing Turkish security forces were about to invade the region and stamp out the Kurdish militia. SDF spokesperson Ahmad Musa made this statement in response.
We will not attack Turkey, but if they insist on attacking us and occupying our lands, we will call upon our right to defend ourselves until the last drop of blood.
On Wednesday, Turkish security forces began moving into northern Syria in a military offensive that has left 16 dead so far, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. With Syrian Democratic Forces on their own and the future of the Kurdish militia unclear, many are worried that ISIS cells could take the opportunity to regain a foothold. Joining us now to help us understand all this is Robin Wright. Robin is a Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow and a columnist at The New Yorker. Robin, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
And we're also joined by Danny Gold, a freelance war correspondent who has reported in the region. Danny, thanks for being with us in studio.
Thanks for having me.
Robin, let's start with you. The timeline here is a little confusing. After Sunday's phone call, President Trump seemed to send mixed messages about whether he was endorsing Turkey's incursion. Where does the president stand on this?
Well, the president has said he thinks the invasion is a bad idea, but he did remove U.S. forces. And he did effectively give a green light to President Erdogan of Turkey to move across the border and create a new safe zone. This has been an effort by the U.S. repeatedly to try to stall an invasion. A special envoy has been talking with the Turk, but making little progress. The Kurds have made a number of concessions so that the Turks would feel safer, but they were apparently not enough, and Turkey went ahead and did what it has long threatened to do.
Danny, has the Turkish offensive in Syria started in full force? I mean, what is the extent of Turkey's military operations today?
It's really hard to tell, actually. We've seen reports of numerous airstrikes, not just in the small region where they were originally going to go in, but as far east as the city known as Derik and Kamishli, which are big population centers. I've also seen reports of ground incursions, but it's hard to tell. There's so much different news coming out of there, what's accurate and what's not. I don't think it started full-fledged. There's already been, you know, civilian casualties and people fleeing the region and refugees sort of trying to head out of these areas already, though.
Robin, President Trump said that there were very few soldiers in the area and that we had a very small presence on the ground that was removed. How accurate is that? How many forces did we actually have there?
Until December, the United States had about 2,000 special forces. Troops on the ground in different places in that northeast third of Syria. The number was brought down probably about half what it was, but they are, again, very sparsely spread out in northeast Syria. They operate out of a base, actually, in northern Iraq. the president has signaled in the midst of the growing chaos in Syria that he thinks it's time to pull all U.S. forces out. He threatened to do that in December. He now seems closer to doing that, despite the advice from the Pentagon and even many at the State Department that this is not the time, that the war against ISIS is not finished, that there's still a lot to do in stabilizing the area so that ISIS doesn't come back as it did in Iraq.
And to that point, I mean, talking about the U.S. troops who are still in Syria, Jen Griffin from the Fox News has been tweeting about this. She says, and I'm quoting her here, that she spoke to a U.S. soldier on the ground in Syria, and that soldier told her, quote, "The Kurds are as close to Western thinking in the Middle East as anyone. It's a shame. It's horrible. This is not helping the ISIS fight." Robin, are you expecting a similar reaction from U.S. troops who remain?
I've interviewed many of the U.S. troops who have served in Syria. I was there in March with the Kurds, the Syrian Democratic Forces. The Americans have a very close working relationship with this militia. They are among our closest allies in the Middle East. They did what all the other groups we tried to train and arm could not do, ended up either collapsing or turning into warlords. The Kurds actually took on ISIS, forced them out of an area the size of Indiana, and have been very effective in holding them back. The Kurds are still in control of close to 12,000 ISIS fighters held in prisons. Remember, this is not a state. This is just a militia. And they have more than 70,000 family members, women, children mainly, in a detention camp in the area that's exposed to the Turkish invasion as well. The great question is not just the fate of the Kurds, our close ally, but what about ISIS? Because as of yesterday, the operation against ISIS was stopped. The Kurds cannot fight on two fronts at the same time.
Danny, let's talk a little bit about the history here. Why does Turkey want to stamp out Kurdish forces in northern Syria?
The SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, is a rebranding. That happened in 2015. The group that the SDF mostly consists of is known as the People Protections Unit, or the YPG. Now, they are a Syrian Kurdish group that was formed roughly around 2004. They are actually an offshoot of the PKK, which is the Kurdistan Workers Party, which was formed about 40 years ago in Turkey. And it's an insurrectionary movement. The Kurdish population in Turkey in the southeast has been horrifically repressed. We're talking ethnic cleansing, brutal imprisonments, even genocide at various times. So that group rose up in 1978, and they fought this battle against the Turkish government. The Turkish government views them as terrorists. The U.S. actually has them on the terrorist list. The YPG, which formed in Syria, is an offshoot of that group. So in the Turks' eyes, that group is a terrorist organization. You know, they're more threatened by the YPG and the SDF than they are by ISIS.
How have those past offenses in Syria played out?
They've played out with well-documented grievous human rights violations, looting and ethnic cleansing that groups like Human Rights Watch have called attention to. That happened in a small area in northwest Syria called Afrin that was sort of a Kurdish enclave. Turkey went in there in January of 2018, and you've seen a large population of internally displaced people fleeing that area for the area that Turkey is now attacking. So not only are you going to have refugees from that area that were based there for a long time, but you also have refugees that fled from the previous area that Turkey attacked.
Robin, why is Erdogan launching this campaign into Turkey now?
I think he feels that the time is right now as the Syrian civil war grinds down, as ISIS, or the caliphate anyway, has been defeated. It does not hold territory. It's turned into an insurgency, which in some ways is just as dangerous. But this is the moment to do it, to establish a fait accompli, so that when it gets around to talking about the future of Syria, as the Turks, the Russians, and the Iranians are trying to do in joint diplomacy, that Turkey can claim it holds this area and may not give it up.
And Robin, we mentioned in the introduction that Kurdish forces are now going to be defending themselves. Do they have the capacity to do that? Are they prepared for this escalation?
This is a very uneven match. Turkey is the ninth most powerful military in the world. It has over 350,000 active troops and double that with reserves. It has over 500 warplanes, thousands of tanks and artillery pieces. The Kurds have vintage equipment, only about 60,000, including reserves, men and women. a few captured Soviet-era tanks, no air force. Their ability to hold off Turkey will be due to their commitment to preserve what they consider to be their homeland. The Kurds are the largest minority in the world and the largest minority in Turkey and a very significant minority in Syria, too. And they don't really have any place to go.
Danny, there were reports of civilians who were leaving the region yesterday trying to find a way out as this begins to escalate. Is there any effort on the part of Turkish forces to protect civilian lives?
It's tough to say. You know, they have been hitting civilian areas. You may see some lip service paid about targeting just the militias and not the civilians. But what we saw in Afrin, if that's any indication, civilians might not be specifically targeted, but there's not going to be any care given for them.
The president clearly, in his sort of back and forth, said if Turkey does something that he deems inappropriate, if you will, he's going to destroy their economy. So what does that tell us about the U.S.-Turkey relationship?
You know, Turkey has not been the best partner when it comes to combating ISIS, and that's one of the reasons that the U.S. Worked with the SDF and the Kurdish forces. We've seen sort of give and take there for the past 5, 6, 7, 8 years, but things haven't really settled down in a while. And we've seen this continuous push-pull, you know, ever since we struck up this deal with the Kurdish forces. The Turks are obviously not happy about that. The U.S. needed a reliable partner, and they haven't been able to really, come to a fair agreement on that. So I see the situation there getting worse.
On the point Danny made, President Erdogan is one of the closest allies to President Trump. They have a personal relationship. Erdogan is known to call Trump on his cell phone when he's playing golf on the weekends. That's what he did in December when he convinced Trump, who was playing golf with Tiger Woods at the time, to pledge to withdraw all U.S. troops from Syria. The Pentagon managed to stall that a little bit, but Erdogan called again on the weekend and convinced the president to stand aside and even in the process won an invitation to come to Washington next month. The fact that the president not just pulled out U.S. troops, but invited Erdogan, which is seen as a reward for any foreign leader, to be his guest in Washington is a signal of how much influence the Turkish leader has on President Trump.
Robin, there's another player in this, and that's Russia. There's some speculation that this move by President Trump could actually aid Russia. What are your thoughts on that?
Russia came out and has blamed the United States for its confused foreign policy. One of the things that's unknown is what happens to that third of Syria that's been under the control of the SDF. Do the Russians and the Iranians move in? The Iranians have ground troops, lots of allies, Hezbollah from Lebanon. Do they try to take that territory on behalf of President Bashar Assad? It's a very important territory, not just strategically, but also because many of Syria's oil wells are in that area.
Danny, and just to round this out, I mean, you've also spoken to civilians on the ground there. What is there, as we're talking about this very high-level relationship between Erdogan and Trump, what are the folks who are on the ground right now feeling about what's happening?
They're terrified. You know, they view the Turkish government as an entity that views all of them, civilians including, as terrorists. For the Kurds, a lot of people view the PKK and the YPG as freedom fighters, even though the Turks view them as terrorists. People told me that, you know, for a while they feared being killed by ISIS. Now they fear being killed by the Turkish government.
Danny Gold is a freelance war correspondent, and Robin Wright is Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow and columnist at The New Yorker. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
More than 2 million Californians are without electricity today in what the state's largest utility is saying is a precaution against wildfires. Pacific Gas and Electric gave customers less than 24 hours notice that it would begin cutting power in more than half of all the counties in the state. The utility's live lines have been blamed for several massive wildfires in recent years, including last year's campfire in the town of Paradise, which killed more than 80 people. Today, PG&E says extreme winds and low humidity have created dangerous conditions for power lines and that deliberate blackouts are the best way to keep people safe. But as residents are gearing up for almost a week of blackouts, some are doubting PG&E's strategy. For more on this, we're joined by Marisa Lagos, political correspondent for KQED. Marisa, always good to have you on.
Always good to be here, Tanzina.
So it's been a day since PG&E started cutting power. How are things looking where you are?
Where I am, it's actually okay. We're in San Francisco, and the utilities long said that the San Francisco area would not actually be affected, but basically everywhere around us is. Parts of the sort of more inner Bay Area, including Oakland and parts of Silicon Valley and the peninsula, and it's very widespread at this point. Essentially, at a briefing on Wednesday evening, and they've been giving briefings every evening, PG&E said that they think that the impact will be a little bit less than they had originally planned, more like 650,000 to 700,000 customers as opposed to 800,000. And of course, a customer is not one person. They average around three people. So as you said, we're talking millions of people.
We were seeing images of folks trying to prepare for the shutdown. Is it true? Are there empty shelves in supermarkets? I mean, what have people been doing to get ready for this?
We saw long lines at gas stations. Obviously, ice was running low everywhere. I mean, for some people, if you're medically fragile, there's huge implications here. But I think for a lot of people, the uncertainty has been really difficult. You know, because of the fact that PG&E kind of sent out this notice far and wide, because of the fact that it is such a big service area, people don't really know. And even within the last day, you know, we saw them warn, well, if your power goes out, it could be out for up to a week. But some areas they were able to restore very quickly on Wednesday. And so I think for a lot of people, it's just been hard to know. And so, you know, being more prepared than less is obviously better. But I think that has created a little bit of a rush at some stores in different regions. What's interesting about this is that there are such sort of populated areas that are being affected. And that's because, of course, a grid is a grid, right? You can't just shut out power to one part and not necessarily impact others. And so I would say that these started more in rural areas. They waited as long as possible to bring them into the Oakland area, the Silicon Valley, San Jose. But it is happening both in rural and more urban areas. And I think that the public sentiment you see out there is for once not partisan. There's a lot of anger at PG&E among what seems to be most California residents.
Well, and also speaking of PG&E, I mean, they've had a complicated history as well. Earlier this year, PG&E announced it was filing for bankruptcy due to claims associated with the deadly wildfires. Where is it now as in its efforts to remain intact?
There's a lot going on with PG&E. The bankruptcy case is still underway. They are hoping to exit by essentially next spring, early summer. When we talk about such a huge monumental decision by this utility to shut down power to millions of people, there's so much distrust because of all the other things I just outlined. And, you know, and it also comes literally on the 2-year anniversary of the 2017 wildfires up in Wine Country in Mendocino that destroyed so many homes and were such a shock to the country, really. And so I think that PG&E is definitely not in the good graces of its customers. And I think what's going to be interesting to watch moving forward is how, you know, the governor, the legislature, policymakers react to these widespread outages, because we really have never seen anything like this in terms of a preemptive shutdown.
But Marisa, I mean, we're in the middle of fire season in California, and this is the first that we're seeing in quite some time. But is this going to be the new normal for California, for PG&E, or whatever utility ends up managing the state?
It is not intended to be a long-term solution. This is supposed to be a short-term way to deal with heightened fire risk during really extreme weather events, which we're having now with, you know, high winds and low humidity. The idea is that in the coming months and years, PG&E will get its act together and do a lot of that maintenance work that we all thought they had been doing, you know, clearing brush around trees, hardening lines, setting up these weather stations, as we've seen other utilities do, and that moving forward, if there are these types of shutoffs, they could be more targeted. But we'll see. You know, PG&E said it wanted to get to around 24,000 miles of line inspection for its safety program this year. And in September, it reported that it had only gotten to about 7,000. Lines. So they are not keeping up even with the maintenance work this year. Obviously, a lot of that was deferred. But, you know, I think that that's really the big question. This is not the way that people want to live in 2019 in the United States of America. There's been a lot of warnings about this, but I think now that it's a reality, the ground could shift a little.
And I wonder if that ground shifting will have any effect on the politics that are happening behind the scenes. I mean, if the state itself or PG&E are going to work toward other solutions to reduce the need for blackouts.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the legislature did tackle a lot of questions this year around wildfire safety and passed a huge insurance fund that will give essentially utilities like PG&E a safety net. So if they were to cause problems in the future in terms of, you know, property destruction, that they won't end up in bankruptcy again. But I certainly think that when lawmakers return in January, as the governor hears from angry residents around the state about this, that it could change the narrative. And we know that a lot of what PG&E is focused its political muscle on is trying to change liability laws and essentially make it less liable for things that it causes when it's not being negligent. So essentially, if it follow the rules, then it won't be held liable on the hook financially. And that's angered a lot of people because the victims from 2017 and 2018 in large part are still waiting for a payout. So I do think that there's a chance that we see a conversation around, you know, cities like San Francisco are offering to buy PG&E's infrastructure within their city limits. I think that, you know, there's definitely a potential for more conversations about whether PG&E should be split up or changed in some way. But, you know, it's a complicated issue. And this is an investor-owned utility. It is traded on Wall Street. It is a monopoly. There are no easy sort of solutions. Even if the state took it over tomorrow, we'd still be plagued by the same maintenance issues and the same infrastructure that, you know, has caused these terrible, terrible blazes in the last 2 years.
Marisa Lagos is a political correspondent at KQED. Marisa, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina.
Last night, the Atlanta Braves were eliminated from the Major League Baseball postseason, but not without some controversy. Braves fans there doing the tomahawk chop at last night's game. It's an entire stadium of people chopping their arms in the air, sometimes swinging foam tomahawks provided by the team, and singing a fabricated war chant. Well, just two pitches into last night's game, after the team announced it would no longer hand out foam tomahawks, fans did it anyway. You see, last week, Ryan Helsley, a rookie pitcher for their opponent, the St. Louis Cardinals, and a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, called the Braves out for allowing their fans to do the offensive tomahawk chop at their games. The team has also encouraged fans by using the hashtag ChopOn and would play the chant's melody through its PA system. The Braves took several days to react, but have since said they take Helsley's concerns seriously, no longer giving away foam tomahawks to fans, and promised to, quote, take several efforts to reduce the tomahawk chop during our in-ball park presentation on Wednesday. Nick Martin is a staff writer for The New Republic and member of the Saponi tribe. He writes about Native and Indigenous issues. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So last week, the St. Louis Cardinals pitcher Ryan Helsley, who's a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, called the Braves out on the offensive, quote, tomahawk chop that a lot of fans use at home games. What was his critique of this?
So after game one that the Cardinals won in Atlanta, Ryan Helsley spoke with the St. Louis Dispatch, and basically what he was trying to acknowledge was that he felt like the tomahawk chop and the chant that accompanies it, he said that it was a misrepresentation of the Cherokee people or Native Americans in general. And it wasn't so much about him being offended, it was just about it's further perpetuates this misconception of Native people as living in the past as being this kind of, he described it as like a caveman type people. And it speaks to like a larger issue in professional and amateur sports where Natives are used as logos and mascots and just kind of caricatures and not in any way, you know, respected by these organizations, but more just used for profit.
Now, let's be clear, the Braves don't have Native caricatures as a mascot or a logo, but what's the history here? That hasn't always been the case, right?
Right. Yeah, that's kind of a recent development. Going all the way back to 1912, so 107 years ago, a member of Tammany Hall, James Gaffney, bought the what were then the Boston Rustlers, and he changed the name to the Boston Braves and changed it to the logo of a Native man wearing an eagle feather headdress. And that kind of stuck with them as they moved to Milwaukee and then Atlanta. And in Atlanta, they actually built in the left field bleachers a teepee, and they would have a mascot and a man in what is kind of more nondescript regalia come out and do a dance around the teepee every time one of the Braves players hit a home run. And so that was briefly retired in 1983. And then the Braves went on a losing streak, and so they brought him back. And his name was Chief Nakahoma, as in like knock a home run. And they finally retired him in 1986, and they removed their logo in 1989. But the tomahawk has remained, and the chant was actually not introduced until 1991, when Deion Sanders, very famous and popular dual sports standout for Florida State University, came and joined the Braves, and he kind of brought it with him from Florida State, whose mascot is the Seminoles.
Now, we also know that there's been use of Native culture in teams. Obviously, we're talking about the Braves, but also the Chicago Blackhawks and the NFL team in Washington, D.C. Why do you think these teams are so resistant to changing the logos and the names that are associated with Native culture and history?
I mean, it comes down pretty simply to money. We're talking about billionaires who own these sports franchises who can easily fund a rebranding effort, but they just don't want to go through the trouble of doing that. And that's why it took so long to get Chief Wahoo off the Cleveland Indians sidelines, and also off of their hats and their jerseys. Like, this stuff has always been kind of a knockout, dragout, years-long fight. I mean, the people have been asking the Braves for movement on this since the mid-90s, specifically the tomahawk chop. And I mean, going even further back for the mascot and the logo for the Washington NFL team, until you can create enough of a public uproar to where it becomes, you know, kind of financially detrimental to continue having the mascot, these team owners aren't going to change it, because they don't interact. They don't partner with Native nations. They don't really care about how Native people feel. And actions always speak louder than words. And in the case of the Braves, that's absolutely true.
One of the exception to that I was going to note here is that the Florida State Seminoles actually have the approval of the Seminole tribe. Why is that unique? How did that come about?
You're absolutely right. And even Florida State wasn't always partnered with the Seminole tribe. They weren't always respectful of their traditions and the way that they would depict them. I believe the mascot's name is Sammy the Seminole, but they had a white person dressing up, and he'll ride out on a horse and put a spear in midfield ahead of the games. And, it took a long time for them to partner with the tribe. But once they did that, it's able to produce both like a financial and a cultural two-way street that allows the tribe to not be wholly giving up its name and likeness and image rights. Florida State has started to implement more Native classes and whatnot into their curriculum. And it's something, it is unique. It's a rare instance in which an athletic program saw that it was doing something wrong and sought to kind of right that. And I mean, it's heartening, but it's absolutely the exception to the rule.
Now, what's the solution, if you will, here? I mean, is it just scrapping the offensive chants altogether, or is it something similar to what Florida State was able to achieve? Obviously, these are multi-million dollar franchises that do not have an educational arm to, as you said about Florida State, really incorporate or expand the Native curriculum there. So I'm not sure if a partnership would work, but is that one way to approach it?
I mean, if asking me personally, my approach would be that with Florida State, they were mentioning a specific tribe, right? I mean, you're talking Blackhawks, the Kansas City Chiefs, Washington NFL team, Atlanta Braves. These are all just kind of general stereotypes of what, Americans view Native people as nowadays. It historicizes us. It makes us a people of the past and not a people of the present, which we are. My solution to that is, it might sound a little radical to these teams, but they should all just change their names. There's a, like, if you look across the board in the NFL, NHL, MLB. Like, there's no other racial group that is leaned on so heavily to just function as a mascot. These sports institutions, when they implemented them originally, whether it's in 1912 or throughout the 20th century, they didn't have to think about it because we weren't a presence in the media. We weren't a presence in politics. We weren't around in a way that forced them to look at it. And so my response would be just change your name. I mean, then you obviously do away with the chants and the emotions and all of that. I mean, I know that it would cost money, but it's cost us, I think, a lot more over the years to have been placed in the past by these mascots and just kind of ignored. So, yeah, change the name.
Nick Martin is a staff writer for The New Republic and a member of the Saponi tribe. Nick, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
When I was 22 years old, I had an experience that a lot of women will recognize. I had been promised a job for the next year, all hired and set to go. And then when they realized that I was pregnant, the job was given to someone else.
Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren spoke up this week about her experience with pregnancy discrimination. She says she lost a teaching job in the 1970s because she was visibly pregnant. And while that was decades ago, pregnancy discrimination is still widespread today and can take much more subtle, insidious forms in the workplace, like being passed over for big projects or promotions. And you told us about your experiences.
My name is Anna, and I'm calling from Canby, Indiana. I have been told by a manager that I was not being moved to a position where I would make more money because I was, quote, leaving soon. When I worked at an OBGYN, I saw patient after patient be slowly bullied into quitting their jobs. Anyone who says this isn't happening in the 21st century is just plain wrong.
My name is Denise, and I'm calling from Louisville, Kentucky. I did not face discrimination, however, my daughter did. She worked at a conveyor company in Louisville, and she had very bad morning sickness while she was pregnant, and she would be sick on her way to work, and she was late a lot, and she got wrote up while there were guys there that were late all the time and were never written up.
Hi, I'm Crystal from St. Petersburg, Florida. Yes, I have been discriminated at work because I was pregnant. I was working 62 hours a week, and when I complained, I was told I shouldn't have gotten pregnant. The stress led me to a premature birth at 27 weeks. My baby eventually died at the age of 11 months old as a result of the complications of being born so early.
Thanks for sharing your stories. And remember, you can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm going to talk now to Joan C. Williams about the legal history surrounding pregnancy discrimination and what's being done today to protect pregnant workers. Joan is the director of the Center for Work-Life Law and a professor at the University of California Hastings College of Law. Joan, thanks for being with us.
Delighted to be back, Tanzina.
So Congress passed the Pregnancy Discrimination Act in 1978. What did that do?
Well, Title VII, the basic anti-discrimination statute, was passed in 1964, and then courts, in their wisdom, decided that discriminating against someone based on pregnancy was not discriminating against someone based on sex, which on its face is ridiculous, and that's what Congress said in 1978 in the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which said that discriminating against someone based on pregnancy or related medical conditions is sex discrimination.
So this act was passed in 1978, and yet complaints to the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, about pregnancy discrimination are reportedly at an all-time high. Nearly 31,000 charges were filed between 2010 and 2015. Why is that, given that we have this act?
Really, it goes back to how we define the ideal worker. We define the ideal worker as someone who starts to work in early adulthood and works full-time, full force for 40 years straight, needing no time off for childbirth or child-rearing. You know, who does that describe? It describes a man. And so we, in an informal but very powerful way, still define the ideal worker as someone who never gets pregnant. And so when a worker gets pregnant, often the response of the employer is, why are you making me deal with your private issue? Their response, for example, is very different when someone has a heart attack. When a worker has a heart attack, it's like, oh my goodness, this could happen to anyone. You know, hiring people who have heart attacks is a cost of hiring a workforce, but somehow hiring a worker who gets pregnant is an unseemly intrusion into being an ideal worker.
Let's talk a little bit here, Joan, about what this discrimination looks like, because there's obvious and overt discrimination, which we heard some of our callers describe earlier, and then there's subtle discrimination. Talk a little bit about how employers sideline pregnant women today.
There's a class structure to pregnancy discrimination like anything else. One story we didn't hear, but it's very common among low-wage workers, is that you tell your employer you're pregnant and you're fired 15 minutes later. Often there is nothing subtle about it. It is very, very clear what's going on. We also heard the key way that pregnancy discrimination occurs for women in blue-collar jobs, and often also in low-wage jobs, by the way, which is that when a woman is pregnant, often she needs very simple accommodations. For example, her doctor says she can't stand up for 8 hours in a row, and she's a cashier, so she needs a stool. Just very, very simple. But what employers often do is, although they're very flexible in giving accommodations to everybody else for every other reason, they refuse these simple accommodations for women. So you heard the story, for example, of the woman who was late because of morning sickness being written up for every millisecond she was late, but men weren't. That's also a very common pattern. That's called pregnancy accommodations.
What exactly does one do when they think they're being discriminated against?
If a woman thinks she's being discriminated against because of pregnancy, the first thing to do is to figure out whether she's just being treated differently because she is pregnant. If she is, that itself is sex discrimination. So you should start carefully writing up in detail specific instances of how you were treated differently because you were pregnant. And then call a hotline, 415-703-8276, or consult a lawyer. It's important to talk to a lawyer even if you don't want to sue, because a lawyer can often help you navigate the situation in a way that's going to get where you want to. And for example, on our hotline, that's one of the things we do. It's not just if you want to sue, it's if you want to figure out how to get to where you want to get to. If a woman isn't being given an accommodation, for example, if she's not given a bulletproof vest that can fit around a pregnant woman, and everybody else is being given bulletproof vests that fit them, then it's important, if you want an accommodation, to look around and kind of notice who else has accommodations.
We know that infant and maternal mortality rates are different for women of color in this country, specifically Black women. I know you've studied the impact of workplace discrimination on women of color more broadly, but are there differences in which women are discriminated against when they're pregnant based on race?
Yes, there are. As with everything else in America, race plays a factor. On our hotline, which has been going for 25 years, one of the things that we find often is that the kinds of accommodations that are given without comment to white women are often denied women of color. So there's just outright race discrimination. The other factor is that, of course, class is racialized in the United States, and so women of color are more likely than white women to be in low-wage work. And the most egregious forms of pregnancy discrimination typically take place in low-wage jobs.
Joan C. Williams is the director of the Center for Work-Life Law and a professor at the University of California Hastings College of Law. Joan, thank you.
Thanks, Tanzina.
Hello. I was the only female in my department in construction and engineering field. And after an excellent review, about 6 weeks later, I informed my supervisor that I was pregnant. And then a week later, I was suddenly let go for no longer being a good fit. So I sued and won, because that is very illegal. Pregnancy discrimination happens still today, every day.
Hi, this is Julia from Clayton, California. I actually had a supervisor tell me just after my wedding, "You'd better not plan on getting pregnant or we'll lose you in a layoff." Whether it's discrimination or not, you're still very threatened because we all need our jobs and our income, but it's just really hard to work for people like that.
And that's our show for today. This show is made up by a bunch of amazing people, and I want you to hear their names. Our producers are Ethan Oberman, Amber Hall, Jose Olivares, Rob Gunther, Andres O'Hara, Jivika Varma, and Meg Dalton. Our senior producer is Alexandra Boti. Our digital editor is Polly Arungu. Our board op is Claire McKean. Vince Fairchild is our engineer and director. And Jay Cowett is our sound designer and line director. And David Gable is our bringer of wondrous treats and our assistant. Lita Hollowell is our intern. And Deirdre Depke is our executive producer. Thanks so much for spending your time with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.